This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. So, are you looking to trade gold, maybe silver, platinum, palladium, with low cost and global access? With Interactive Brokers, you can trade spot metals, futures, and options on major exchanges, all from one powerful platform. Get efficient pricing, deep liquidity, and institutional-grade tools right at your fingertips. Whether you're hedging, investing, or even diversifying, Interactive Brokers puts the world of metals in your hands. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC. Futures, of course, are not suitable for all investors. And U.S. gold trading is available only to legal residents of the United States, excluding residents of Arizona, Montana, New Hampshire, Rhode Island. Interactive Brokers, the best informed investors, choose them. Get ready. Get set. Visit interactivebrokers.com/metals and start trading smarter.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The government's back open. Is that a good thing? October's eco data may be lost forever. Investors questioning values. We got the poster child in peril. And our guest today is Ross Gerber from Gerber Kawasaki Wealth. All this and much more on episode number 947 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Markets are not simply recovering? A rotation that is not benefiting tech? How could that be? Come on, what are they talking about? Yeah, we're going to get into this and a lot more today as the Emperor's got some new clothes, doesn't he? Andrew Horowitz here, and yes, risk assets are out of favor for the moment. I mean, look at tech, crypto, and the mess that has been created by the very, I would say, what, aggressive, super aggressive, and reckless promises for companies like OpenAI, Sam Altman, what he does, the poster child of what is going on these days is clearly, in my opinion, Oracle. And we've talked about this a lot. The idea that that we have big concerns over the notion of what's going on with the allocation of capital vis-a-vis things like circular financing, vendor financing, and again, I'll say it again, the word reckless promises about future opportunities from companies like OpenAI that are basically spending money they don't have and they may not ever have. And all of us going along with like, hey, yeah, that's a good idea. When in fact, we know better. We know that the OpenAIs of the world that are promising, what, $1.4 trillion of spend over the next number of years, may or may not be able to do so. But yet, the hope is alive. And we've talked about these concerns about this, but again, the one stock I think that is representative of this valuation concern for us is Oracle. And by the way, we are owners of the stock, love the company, love what they do, love the opportunity. But remember, things got twisted sideways and a bit haywire when they came out with the earnings last month. And at the same time, OpenAI promised hundreds of billions of dollars that was going to be spent on cloud, et cetera, utilizing the Oracle platform, and the stock went vertical. It happened in a flash. Went from 240 on the great numbers that they showed to 330. You know, we're talking about $100, like, you know, close to 40%, 38% of an increase in the stock on the promise from OpenAI. And, you know, you can't discount what is going on there. You can't say that investors were stupid because they got direct and very clear signals from everybody involved that this is something that's going to happen. But now, where are we? Reality is striking. There is a bit of the Emperor's New Clothes that is coming out. And we saw a bit of a turnaround in many of these tech names. Where? 16, 17 is the price now, from 240, 330, back underneath the price that was actually the day before earnings and the good news was announced. So what is this actually, if you stop for a second and think about it, what does this teach us? I think we have to go back to what we know is that hype can really get things going, but it's difficult to sustain. And we all want to believe, we all want to put our money there. We get greedy, all of us do. But you have to be smart about it. The margin levels that we talked about over the last few weeks that we saw at all-time highs told the story. The fact that we saw companies ballooning their stock price on promises that were thinly veiled, questioning nothing more than, oh, okay, how much higher can it go? Not where are they going to get their money from to do this? I'm sure we're going to get into this whole discussion with our guest today, so I'm not going to get too deep into the weeds in this, but this is the reason we actually clipped some profits over the past month, and we've been doing this a long time, and I got to tell you something. I've been doing this a long time. We haven't been clipping our profits for a long time. Over time we have, but I've been doing this a long time, and when things go vertical, it's usually time to reassess. Markets can continue on much longer than we anticipate, and we know that. Bull markets can be sustained for a really long time, whereas bear markets usually are short. It's just what it is. The optimism is always there. When things are great, I want to buy. When things are down, I want to buy. So we have to look at this as, where are we in the cycle right now? And I think this cycle has got pretty long in the tooth, but that rotation that we saw clearly benefiting things like healthcare, value-oriented stocks, staples, utilities, that was something to behold. The people don't want to pull their money out of the market. What they want to do is just move it. So the bullish intent, the opportunity that is there, the optimism that is held is still pretty strong. Now, with the government back open, by the way, and congratulations. I think we have a key for that somewhere here, right? No, that's not it. There we are. There we are. Congratulations, fellas, for a job well done opening up the government after 40-something days. But what does it mean? Well, we possibly going to revisit this January. In January. To get back to that. It seems that we're going to start getting a flow of eco numbers, to a degree. We're not going to see much of October, possibly ever, by the way. The comments out of this administration has been that it is possible that we will never see October numbers, which really is a problem. It screws up charts. It screws up trends. It screws up analysis. I don't really understand why it has to be this way, but that's what it is. We have heard from many officials say that the shutdown could cost as much as 2% off of lap right off the top of GDP, which will smooth out a bit probably in the following quarter as money comes back, people get paid. Hopefully, it's not going to interfere too much in the retail experience during what is about to be, in a couple of weeks, Black Friday and the holiday season. But the biggest issue right now, aside from the things we're talking about, and why markets, I think, are a little bit squirrely, is because Fed officials are still talking a bit hawkish. And there's a real concern that there's not going to be a gift in the stocking this Christmas of a Fed cut. There's going to be a lump of coal. No cuts in December, which I agree with. I don't want you to get cold, but I agree with that. We probably at this point, without the data, as opposed to Stephen Moran, who says, oh, yeah, we need to cut another 0.5%. Without the data, how are you doing this information? How are you doing this analysis without the data? And right now, it seems more logical, healthy, and appropriate to wait it out a little bit. Let's see what's going to happen. Let's spend our time thinking about what we do know about and we do see here. There's no rush to cut in December. Make it the next meeting afterwards if it needs to be. Not going to hurt the economy too much. All right, with that, let's get going with this week's guest, and that is Ross Gerber. I am very excited to have him back. I always enjoy our conversations. He is the co-founder, president, and CEO of Gerber Kawasaki Wealth and Investment Management. He oversees the GK's corporate and investment management operations, as well as serves individual clients. He's become one of the most followed investors of social and traditional media. He's been on CNBC and Fox News and Bloomberg, Reuters. He's a contributing writer for Forbes. He's been ranked as one of the most influential investment advisors and fintech innovators in America. They have billions of dollars under management. So let's get to that discussion. I think it's going to be pretty interesting. So Ross Gerber, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Good to see you. Good to hear you. It's been a little bit of a while. I always enjoy speaking with you and watching you. You are very much out there talking about all the latest and greatest things. I think one of the things I saw you recently talking about was that about a year ago, year and a half ago, you started teaching your kids how to use AI, and they were like, no, I can't do that. And you're like, yes, you can.
Well, no, it wasn't that they said no. It was that their teachers told them that it was like cheating if they used AI. And I said, well, how much do your teachers make?
Yeah.
It was like, not a lot. Well, there's a reason for that. It's because they're threatened by the things that might actually be wonderful for education, actually. And so I immediately taught my kids how to use AI, not to cheat, not to write for them, but to help them learn.
Yeah.
Because AI is a wonderful tutor. It's just a wonderful tutor, especially in things like algebra, which if you're like me and you haven't done algebra for like 40 years, and then your kid's like, I thought you were smart at math, Dad, do this problem. And I'm like, all right, let me dig deep into the burrows of my brain and try to remember how to do that. And then I put it into chat and it just step by step explains how to do every problem. I'm like, damn, if I was a tutor, I'd be worried because this is way better than the teachers and the tutors.
So did you have you done any like long division, like hardcore long division? Not, you know, I'm talking about the long division that's like difficult. I somebody recently was, I'm like, what is that? How do you even do that anymore?
Well, you know, I think a lot of school, when you think about it in hindsight, is really to like learn how to sort of deal with a lot of things, whether you actually use them in real life for the rest of your life. You know, I would say most of it you don't, right?
Yeah.
But like you think about how important it is to do math, you know, like to know just basic math that you use every day, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's, you know, tipping somebody or this or that, a lot of people can't figure out 20% on a tip. You know, and so there's that. And then you get into the sort of like algebraic equations. And then you get into calculus where my kids are kind of like, well, what do you use this for, Dad? And I go, nothing really. You know, like most of what I do is financial. So it's really just like accounting, you know?
But it's like anything else. You have to have a base knowledge in something. Like if you have a base knowledge in how a car works, at least you have an idea of that. You know, if you have a base knowledge of, if I started only using Excel, I don't think I'd have the core understanding of how to understand the calculations right. That went into something.
Right. So this is the whole thing that everybody fears is like that our brains turn to mush because AI brains will just like do everything for us. And then we're like not capable of doing simple math or figuring out where things are or even knowing how to be happy anymore because computers will just do everything for us. And I think that's what I try really hard with my kids is like, no, put that down, like learn how to like do stuff. You know, one of the nice things about living in an area that's burned down is that you see a lot of construction.
That's not something you hear very often.
What's right. Nice well, living nobody in an area actually lives in an area burned down except right. For me. You know, there's like, I don't know, what do I got? A couple, maybe 25 neighbors, you know,
right.
As we're on the border, you know, like mm-hmm. I fought the fire and saved my house and the part of the Palisades where we live, there was a small group of us and then ultimately saved by the firefighters. But our neighborhood's fairly normal other than two blocks away is the biggest disaster zone I've ever seen. And now it's being rebuilt. And when you see construction, it gives me hope that humans will have plenty of jobs for a long time, because I think these humanoid robots, it's going to take a long time for them to be as good to do roofing and things like that.
Yeah. Let's go to the core of this. Let's talk about one of the things I know I'll tell everybody else that hasn't maybe heard you before, which is probably only a few people, but Ross is always on the cutting edge and coming at looking at these areas, particularly in technology. And I want to talk about this AI thing that we're talking about here. And the notion of what AI is and what it isn't, right? I think that's an important distinction that I think people don't really understand. There's this AI that people think is more like smart computing, and then this AI that is that next level, right? That kind of thinking.
They call it like AGI, like it's smarter than humans. It knows everything.
So where are we? What is the difference?
Where are we at right now is that AGI, AI is still pretty dumb, actually. If you ask it, what are the best paintings for me to see when I go to the Uffizi Gallery in Florence, it'll give you a good list of stuff that you want to see. But when you say, explain to me this specific painting and the story behind it, it doesn't know. And so the tour guide knows. And so the humans are still vastly more intelligent on specifics than what AI is. And so AI is really good at certain things like languages. It's really good at math. It's really good at analysis of documents or pictures, but it's not actually that intelligent yet. And most of what AI is doing right now is just what I call advanced search, where it's like looking at the documents you're requesting and then summarizing them for you and giving you the best parts of that information. And so it's highly efficient right now, but I wouldn't call it super intelligent.
I mean, I love it, by the way, love it for help on minor rewrites, grammar.
Oh, it's amazing.
Just things like that, where you take an email and say, can you just clean this up for me? And you get it back and it looks almost the same, but you realize, wait, you know what? That was reversed. And that looks, that sequence of that sentence is a lot cleaner and looks better.
It's great for presentation formats, you know, like, can you put this into a PowerPoint? Or like, it now knows, like, what I'm doing is I hate Excel, like the formulas and stuff. Mm-hmm. And now it like knows that you want to keep doing that formula. You don't have to keep putting it in, you know, things like that. So those intuitive things are great. But what you're saying, like for me, like I write a decent amount, you know, and it used to really bother me because nobody in the company could edit that good, you know?
Right.
And it's like, do I have to hire somebody just to like edit documents? And then, you know, you go through this process of this back and forth with documents until you're basically happy with it. And then like somebody points out something you made a mistake on. You're like, shit, I almost got it right. You know, but I write, let's say, a fund report for the quarter for the GK fund, let's say. And so the way I do it now versus the way I used to do it is I basically, I dictate it into my phone. Mm-hmm. And then I put it into chat and I say, write this for me in investor letter format, you know, and it does it and it's great. And if I don't like some of the things it do, I just edit it. But like, it's a 15 or 20 minute process that used to be like hours, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I have back in during COVID, I did a Monday, maybe Monday and Wednesday, but it was at least a Monday webinar that I invite everybody to come to that wanted to sit there and panic with me about all the stuff going on during COVID. I mean, straight up right from the beginning of it, right? You know, what was going on? And what I would do is I would take a pad, like one of those yellow pads, and I would write each day what I'm going to talk about. I have that entire, I don't know, is that 70, 80 page pad, 100 page pad, I guess. I have that 100 page pad filled up. I was thinking about taking that, scanning it, putting it into, one of the AIs and say, write this in a story for me or something of that nature, right? You know, kind of like give this.
Yeah, like tell the story of all these notes.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe something I'll do. But that's the kind of thing it's good at.
No, it would be great at that.
Yeah.
And I've thought about that too, you know, because like I saw a customer service thing that was basically chat, but it was like geared towards the company. So it was like, ask me whatever you want to know about like using my company. But it like was AI. And I was like, dude, this is awesome. I've got to do this where we like feed in everything about like Gerber Kawasaki into AI. And then when people come to the website and they have questions, they can just ask AI about the company and it'll answer it because it will know, you know? Mm-hmm. And like all of a sudden you've like created a customer service function for your business, no matter how big or small your business is, that could be extremely effective compared to the current system of like sending a message to some customer service rep. You know, customer service reps are in trouble. I would say that.
Well, I would also say, and go back to your conversation about how like tour guides, I was in a town outside of Montepulciano, Italy, just a month and a half ago. It was called Orvieto. And I was standing.
Oh, I love that town.
Great town, right? I was standing in front of that.
You talking about the one on the hill?
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh my God. That town is so cool.
Right.
It's like the only place that was never conquered because it was like so well built.
Yep. And that beautiful church with the dome and all that. And
yeah, it was the church with the Jewish stars in front of it.
Exactly. So I went in front of it, though. I'm standing there and going, what am I looking at? Gosh, I literally said this. I wish I had a tour guide with me right now. And then I'm like, you know, I have an idea. So I went in, I turned on my AI, and I started saying, hey, what am I looking at right now? What is this? What is this? What is this? It gave me a pretty good discussion about what I was looking at, right?
And I would do, too.
The people I was with had no idea how this was going. There was this product available, right? And they're like, what is that? What are you doing? I'm like, what do you mean, what am I doing? It's Copilot from Microsoft. It's just a nice, easy app that just, you know, gives me all this stuff. And they were like the whole time freaking out. Let me ask it this. Let me ask it that. It's fascinating the amount of things that can be done today. We talk about some of the small items, right? Whether it's the formulas, the teaching a little bit, the rewrites, the brainstorming, the organization. Companies are spending an awful lot of money on what they hope it to be one day, right? Where we have the ability for it to, I don't want to bring up the Terminator kind of thing, but think, right? You know, they want to think. And then therefore it can do other things, right? Okay. So there's a big question about what's going on right now. Is it in a bubble? What's going on? We've seen some rockiness in a lot of names after I'll be honest. There is one particular thing I've been talking about that's concerning me. It's the vendor financing, circular financing.
Right.
The issues, particularly with OpenAI. With OpenAI. And I'm like, wait, what? You know, you're promising, you know, $1.4 trillion on losses over those years. And all these companies are making, you know, are basically banking on this. No, or you have like a Microsoft that is paying big money. Like, I'm going to use a number. This is a stupid number. $1 million to a company XYZ. And then they turn around and utilize that to pay back Microsoft for a 5-year contract on Azure, right? And basically,
or SoftBank selling $6 billion in NVIDIA stock,
right,
to buy OpenAI stock,
right,
which will buy NVIDIA chips.
Right. So you basically, in a way, companies are taking money off their balance sheet and putting it onto their income statement, right? That's what they're doing to boost up their profits. You have OpenAI making these promises, like Oracle. Oracle, for example, you saw what happened there. We actually, full disclosure, own Oracle, had that great pop after earnings, and then it's just basically deflated from there back down to...
Yeah, but it's up 100% in the last year.
I got that. I'm just talking about from that one announcement. I'm just talking about the announcement.
Yeah.
So with all that...
You want a smooth stock market?
Yes, I do. What do you mean? Straight up? Just no doubts, of course.
How long have you been doing this? It doesn't work that way.
Hold that thought for a second. We're going to come right back to that. I want to talk about Interactive Brokers for a second. I don't want you to be fooled by what you see out there, these zero commissions that you see all over the place on crypto trades, because some brokers add a spread to the price you pay. But at Interactive Brokers, there are no hidden fees, and you'll pay much less than you would at a place like Gemini, Robinhood, or Fidelity. Keep more in your pocket and trade crypto for less coin at Interactive Brokers. Trading cryptocurrencies involves risk and is only for individuals with a high risk tolerance and the financial ability to sustain losses. Compare other brokers' fees and see how much you can save at ibkr.com/crypto. Now, getting back to Ross Garber, we're talking about bubbles and we're talking about the valuations. And I guess the question is, you know, Ross, is it a bubble?
Definitely not in a bubble. We're not in a bubble for many reasons. I've been in bubbles. Fortunately for me, I was in two of the biggest bubbles ever, and I'm sure you were too, with .com and the real estate crash, which... Yep. You know, fortunately during the real estate period of time, I wasn't in real estate much, but whatever real estate I had at that time, I lost 100%, let's say. And during the .com crash, which was extremely painful, I had also made a fortune in the previous 5 years. You know, the S&P was up 20% a year from 95 to 2000 before the market peaked, and then went down about 50 to 60%. Mm-hmm. So if you go back into the bubble-ish eras of those times, when there's a bubble, the feeling is manic. Like, everybody is making money doing this. Why are you not doing this? That literally nobody questions the bubble. What they question is why you're not doing this. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Why are you so
when you got a whole bunch of people every day going, are we in a bubble? Are we in a bubble? You know for sure we're not in a bubble, because you're only in a bubble when nobody's questioning it.
Right. What a big, I understand that. Right. That,
and then somebody like me, who's like trying to be rational, who manages billions of dollars, is trying to be rational. It's like Palantir stock, you know? Mm-hmm. And you're like trying to be rational. It's like, explain this valuation. There's no explanation for it. Right. So yes, is Palantir in a bubble? Yeah. I mean, there's a couple stocks that are absurd. Tesla, you know, maybe is a little overpriced, you know? But it's like, when you look at the market, when you look at Microsoft and Google and Meta, Meta's like 20 times earnings. I mean, come on, what bubble are they in?
It's kind of interesting, you know? Though, that you get to the point that things are, if you don't want to use
so
the
Microsoft's PE was twice as high during .com than it is today.
Correct. That's Microsoft. You look at Palantir,
and they're still doing well.
Yeah, no, I get that. You know, you look at what happened with Michael Burry. Did you see that last week? He put out a letter to his client. He closed shop. He closed shop. By the way, fascinating.
Closed shop today. Yeah.
Closed shop. Like, done.
I mean, it's not really a shop. Okay, it's $150 million,
right.
You know?
I know, like, but still, he closed. He didn't have to close.
It was like three clients.
But he didn't have to close. I don't know if he was making a statement. He's gonna
I think that his AUM, you know, you have to have at least $100 million in AUM to file a shop. And he was at $150 million, and he short a bunch of stuff, And you know, quite frankly, I think he just doesn't want the scrutiny.
Yeah, I would agree with that part. I think so. And he just gave up and threw his hands up and all. But kind of fascinating.
This betting business is a tough business.
You mean talking about with the options and all that?
Yeah, and just this idea, like, I'm gonna bet that Palantir is gonna fall to $50.
That was his
in the next 2 years, right, which is what he's betting. Yep. And he bet $10 million, let's say, mm-hmm. on this bet. And I'm going, you know, he doesn't even make money until it gets to $50. And I'm like, you know, when you're doing these kinds of things, it seems to me that you're not good at just buying Google and being happy with that.
Right.
You know, like, I always figured if I can make 10 to 20% a year over the long term, consistently over long periods of time, you make millions and millions of dollars, which turns out to be true. Buffett, probably the king of all time, made, let's say, 20% a year over the last 40 years. I mean, he's made fortunes. So you don't have to go out and make 100x your money and be the big short guy, you know? Well, he was lucky the first time that it all paid off for him. He should just be happy. You know what I mean?
And there's a lot of people that did the same thing he did. They didn't have the financial wherewithal to stick it out as long, or the
cojones.
Yeah. And they just got out and got killed, and he just stayed in, and that was great. So who knows if he's going to be right, by the
way. But it's a horrible way to make money. Horrible. It's like a really hard way to make money.
Mentally.
Versus buying Google and just like sitting on it for the next 20 years.
Exactly.
And you know, since we brought up Microsoft, if you bought Microsoft at the high in 1995 and you held it to today, how do you think you did?
You did very well.
You know, you bought it in 99 at the absolute high.
Very well.
You know,
yep.
How did you do?
Yep.
You know? And so, like, the truth of the matter is Microsoft's been wildly successful. Valuations have changed over time. But what we're beginning on with AI is what I call useful computing. See, what most people don't understand is most of the data we've gathered over the last decade, and we put it onto these server farms on AWS, and we have these great, you know, abilities to buy things and get them right away, or to entertain ourselves endlessly on video games or whatever. This has been a wonderful era of growth of this sort of cloud-based computing system. But what happened was, you look at all this data and you go, what's the point of it all? Like, yep. I got a sales force. Like, so what does this tell me? It doesn't tell me anything. It's organizational.
Yeah, it's two-dimensional.
But it's two-dimensional. Yeah. Now all of a sudden I throw AI on it and I say, and I'm able to talk to it. And I say to you, you know, who are my best clients, not based off AUM, but based off client satisfaction and deposits divided by AUM, you know, like, mm-hmm. you know, who are really my best clients who refer me the most people? And then it could like spit out a list, you know, and then you could make modifications. So being able to now use data, put them on GPUs, build new data centers. And this is why I'm not worried about that the spend. See, what most people, when they say, oh, it's losses forever. Now, Google, Microsoft, Apple, all these companies have so much cash and they make tons of cash and it sits on their balance sheets. Kind of like what Berkshire Hathaway is doing right mm-hmm. now. This provides no value to shareholders. Okay. So having $75 billion in Microsoft's balance sheet that doesn't do anything helps shareholders none. So I'm in the camp, you either buy back your stock or you pay dividends or you invest it. So when you invest in a data center, you're making a capital investment like into a factory that will not pay off in year one. You are spending a pretty large amount of capital, let's say 10 to 20 billion to build this data center. And then your expectation is over the next 5 to 10 years, you would recoup your capital and make a return and it will support your other businesses, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And so when people look at what OpenAI is doing and say this is crazy or incestuous or whatever, what they don't understand is that if OpenAI doesn't do this, it will not be the leader in AI. And so it is such a competition to see who will divide up the wealth of AI creation that if you don't invest now and if you don't go full out like Elon did and like Meta's doing, you have zero chance of competing against them.
But this is very Elon-esque.
Apple just chose to stay out of the game. Apple's like, I'm out.
What Sam Altman like, is doing is very Elon-esque, right? It's making these huge, 100%. Huge pie in the sky, which, by the way, it doesn't always pay off. Let's be honest. I don't care
how smart. No, it doesn't.
But they're going out. OpenAI just seems to be a little bit on the edge to me from the aspect of it's difficult enough for a company that is established and making earnings over the last 50 years that is well known and with a product that has been tried and true to forecast more than, let's say, a year out. These guys are trying to forecast 5-8 years out on a new technology that is unproven. They right. basically have to get to the next level before this happens and spending an awful lot of money on it. Now, I'm all in favor that it's all going to work out great and everybody's enough of a pie for everybody to share, but I mean, AI was what? I'm going to go on a limb here. 5 years, maybe three, but five is really the totality of the technology of what we're looking at today. Well,
that's hard to predict. That's hard to predict because, you know, these GPUs, they'll have better GPUs, but they're so good now. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the depreciation lifespan will be for these, but I suspect that they'll run for some time. Even if they're not the most cutting edge chips, you know, 5 years from now.
So we get
what I, but what I think is what, you know, going back to what you were saying, you know, Sam Altman is cut from the Elon Musk cloth of massive statements about stuff because you can't raise money from Silicon Valley unless you just bullshit the hell out of people. And that's the way it works in Silicon Valley. Yeah. I say this all the time, you know, like private equity guys pitch me all the time, like, oh, we want to buy part of your company and this and that. And if I tell them the truth, which is we're going to grow 20% a year for the next 10 years, and you can just put it in your fucking formula and figure out what we're worth, you know, it's just not as exciting as if I tell them some fantastical story about how we're going to redo finance never before. And I need, you know, $100 million to build the greatest AI financial planner ever. And I could probably raise on a $2 billion valuation, you know, if I made up this fake story about some AI financial advisor that will have all of our combined 30 advisors' intelligence put into one so they know how to do IRAs better than anybody else, you know.
It's true, though.
So that story I could sell. I could raise tons of money.
Right, you're not overstating
that. There's guys doing it now.
Yeah, of course.
There's guys doing it.
Literally, and everybody listening, he's not overstating. This is not.
For me, I'm good. I'm good. You know, like what I think is that humans are amazing. I think tech people don't give humans enough credit because they're not such great humans. And so when you are around great humans, you realize like this AI stuff is exactly how Star Wars will be. Okay. And I think Star Wars is a wonderful vision of the future. And when you think about how R2-D2 and C-3PO work together in Star Wars, I think that will be how robotics will look like and AI in the future. where you have a humanoid robot that's super annoying that tells you statistics, and you have this weird purpose-filled robot that will actually do stuff that is very useful for you. And I think that it won't look like a human. And so I think what the future brings right now is a completely open field. And anybody who has this claim that they think what 7 or 8 years in the future is going to be like, it's not going to be like that. And we don't know.
Right.
That's the fun and beauty of it. When I invested in Apple, I did not know about the iPhone. I didn't know that that could exist. Mm-hmm. I was pretty happy with the iPod Nano at the time, you know? But I think where the risk is if you remember back in the days, one of my first great stocks was a company called AOL, and it's very much like OpenAI. Clearly. Very much so.
Well, because they're the first in. Well, not the first.
They were the first in. Right, they sent out tons of disks to everybody so that you could have online access. People didn't really sign up at first. It was like $25 a month, which was like a lot of money in 94, 95, you know. And like they just – and people are like, what is this strategy? Just send everybody disks in America and like they're just going to sign up for this internet? Like what is – what do I even need this for? Like – email, you know,
what's that?
You got mail, you know, so like my generation, you got mail was like a big deal,
right.
You know?
Right.
And so when I signed up for AOL in 95 or 94, I was like, this is awesome. I'm going to send somebody an email. And there was like nobody to send emails to, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And AOL was a revolution. And all of a sudden you could plug your computer into the wall and it would do stuff, you know, and you could, but AOL rallied like crazy until 99. I was fortunate enough to be at the New York Stock Exchange at the top of the market in 1999 when Time Warner purchased AOL. It was the craziest thing I've ever seen. That's why I know bubbles, because I was in it, you know?
Yeah.
And so at that point, from 99 to today, AOL still exists. And I think it was just sold again to some weird company in Europe for some reason, which I don't understand, you know?
I mean, what does it have? I mean, that was with
AOL's mail and news. Mail. That's the app right now, because I still have my AOL address and I still use AOL. And I use AOL and Yahoo because it makes me feel good.
Oh, well, there you go. You know, it's funny. I read a number of years ago, a Harvard Business Review.
I don't use Instagram.
A number of years ago, I read a Harvard Business Review article, and it was talking about the second in advantage. And it was this discussion of things like AOL or other companies that you could think about that were taken over by the second in, where, for example, is McDonald's and Burger King. Or, you know, you look at the different companies that are out there that have that. And that could be something, because they look at, you know, for example, Lowe's versus Home Depot, right? The second in was Lowe's. And, and you look at that, and there's something to be said about, like, who is going to be that second in that's going to learn, whether it's a Perplexity, whether it's, you know, Google's, whether it's going to be XAI. I don't know, you know, which, by the way,
Google
supposedly raised another $15 billion or something like that.
Yeah, I was stoked because I own some of that, and I think they raised that at a $200 billion valuation, which means I doubled my money.
There you go.
So I'm happy.
Which is interesting because the valuations there, I think, are a little bit nutso.
Well, if you want to talk about bubbles, the private market is where it's at.
Yeah. You're talking about credit or equity or both?
Both.
Yeah.
Like the way my business is so freaking weird sometimes. Like the way, see, the whole purpose of private investments was that it wasn't for the public.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
And now they're trying to sell private investments to the public, but they're not liquid. And then what happens is you don't have a market. So they'll say, oh, we're raising at this valuation. We're raising at this valuation. But it doesn't mean those companies are worth that. Do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, I understand. I get it.
So people are like, I want to get in on Anduril. And they're like, all right, well, we're raising money in Series F at, you know, you can buy 5% of the company for, you know, $75 billion, you know. So is OpenAI worth $500 billion? Mm-hmm. Like, no way.
Right.
No way.
Right. Right.
But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Well, that's the funny thing, because it doesn't matter.
Because only private investors, you know, which are supposed to be smart and sophisticated investors, are dumb enough to pay that, I guess.
I have clients that have more private equity and hedge funds and even interval funds that we have to babysit until we can unwind them.
Right.
And, you know, whether it's some of these guys are buying whiskey barrels
Yeah.
You know, or they're buying some other, who knows what.
There's so much garbage, private stuff. It's now, see, you know, because we manage a lot of money and we have a lot of money come in every year. Mm-hmm. So we're one of the, we're what I call 100% organic. We don't buy firms. People just give us money to invest because we're good. Mm-hmm. You know, so every week we take in, let's say 10 to 20 million of new capital. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so these people call us like rabid dogs, you know? And so I got every private equity company pretty much calling us like rabid dogs, except the huge ones, which like don't need anybody because everybody calling them for some reason.
Yep.
And so they all call me and it's all the same, which is access. Like, oh, well, we have access to private stock in this and private stock in that. And it's like, but what does that matter if you're paying five times what the company's worth?
Yeah, plus a 15% spiff.
Right.
To get in.
Oh, I don't even want to go into all the fee stuff because, you know, we're an RIA. So we charge 1% or less typically for pretty much all clients unless you're a super small client. And so, like, you know, I try to keep my fees all in at 1% or less with the ETFs and whatever. And so it's like, you know, when you think about a hedge fund or a private equity guy coming in and saying, I want 2 and 20, which works out to be something like 4 to 5% annually, mm-hmm. if they're successful. It's like, I'm like, why would you get paid five times more than me? You know? Yep. And then they're like, oh, well, we're happy to share some of these fees with you because obviously it's excessive.
Not to mention that they're creating their own valuations on the to get to the 20.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You know what? I can value my company. I can value my company. We're a private company. And I there's like 8 formulas I could use. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Which formula would I use is the one that gives me the best valuation, right?
Yeah, I get it. And by the way, did you see that Schwab purchased a private equity platform just what?
Well, this is what happened. This is what happened. So we're like, oh, we should be doing private equity, like, because we're Gerber Kawasaki and we want to be able to like do everything that clients want, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, all right, I'll look into it. So first company we talked to, EquityZen, right? EquityZen, good company. I really like these guys. And we talked to Forge too, but I didn't like Forge because the stock is public and they're losing like tons of money. You know, like I was like, this is not a good company. And so of course Schwab pays $600 million for it.
Uh-huh.
And then like this EquityZen, we were pretty close to starting to work with, but then it got into like, well, okay, I want to buy something today. Like what can you actually offer me? And it was like 4 or 5 different securities. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like total. And so I found one and I was like, send me the information on this. And they sent me the information. And I'm looking at this stuff and I'm like, these valuations make no sense. Of course, there's no negotiation in any of this. And then of course there are different fee structures depending on whether it's an SPV or whether it's a direct purchase or, you know, it's like, and I was like, you know, I've invested in probably 10 private companies in my life. You know, I've gotten a good return so far on maybe one of them, you know?
Well, not only that, you have the capital calls, you have all that. It's a crazy.
Yeah, but like I invested in Tesla and I invested in Bitcoin. I invested in Nvidia too.
Right.
10 years ago.
Right.
Okay.
And I've made 100 plus without capital calls, without
any of this bullshit.
With total liquidity and no 2 and 20.
And I'm a stock market investor. So that's part of it too. I'm a trader. So if the thing doesn't trade, it doesn't work for me.
Right. No,
because I take advantage of days when the markets are down mm-hmm. to purchase stocks.
Right.
I take advantage of the markets,
right.
You know?
Right.
And so if you're good at this, which is very hard, to be honest, it's very hard for me to do it too. It's not like I have some special skill other than I have no emotion towards money, you know, which is really one of the key features to being able to invest.
Mm-hmm.
Well, is not being emotional about money because you often are losing or gaining lots of money in one day.
Yep.
Like today, I am losing a lot of money and we're not going to be specific about the days, but other days I'm making lots of money.
Right.
But, you know, it doesn't matter to me. What matters to me the most is doing the best we can for our clients. And that is where I care. Like I want to pick the right stocks and do a great job because a lot of people rely on us and we want to do the best job possible for them. And, you know, not just be a bunch of lemmings buying the S&P and, you know.
Yeah, I get it.
Doing nothing.
I get it. Listen, I see that all the time. Stuff comes just like you. Stuff comes through my door. I'm like, who is creating these portfolios? And by the way, from some of the big companies, right? Some major names. I'm like, what? Why would they create this portfolio? You know, you have somebody who is conservative in all equity. You have somebody that's, you know, aggressive and they have this like, you know, weird portfolio of just, and you know, because they got talked into this whole factor or something like that. I want to switch gears. I want to talk about back to the humanoid robots, the idea of R2-D2, C-3PO, or we can call down the lost in space robot, or we can look at you know, Terminator and what's going to happen there, or even you know, or even Hal, you know.
Well, I kind of think that it's possible that a robot might come back in time and kill Elon.
Oh,
you know, like maybe we're living Terminator right now.
Oh,
you know,
oh, and I see what you mean.
And like, you know how like the Terminator came back to kill the person that was going to stop the Terminator.
Right. That was going to solve the whole thing.
Sarah Connor.
Yeah.
And so what I fear is Elon's robot army, you know, like I don't think this is good. I don't actually think humanoid robots have much purpose, to be honest. I think if I'm building a robot, I would want it to be built specifically for what I want it to do. But to be walking around my house and folding laundry, you know, my kid said, and I thought it was very smart, said, why would you spend $1 trillion? Why would Sam Altman spend $1 trillion to make a robot so it can fold laundry?
Yeah.
Like, and serve food.
Rosie, like Rosie from the Jetsons.
Yeah, like I get it if it would only cost $100K to develop something like that.
But it's interesting,
if
because
I'm going to spend $1 trillion, but the whole maybe idea I want of, this thing to do more.
But the whole idea of humanoid robots, listen, we know that Elon, I know that you have a long history, made a lot of money from Elon. He's quirky. Yeah. Let's just say that. He's quirky.
Quirky.
And he's a little bit immature. And he wants to do these things that somehow seem fun. I mean, like, you know, let's play baseball with a humanoid robot. Let's stuff like that. But robots don't necessarily have to be humanoid, right? They could be automation machines of some sort. And they could be then smart thinking, right? Whether it's like you saw in some movies where glass spills from a table and all of a sudden the robot is a little round thing, like a little Roomba, is automatically goes and cleans up the mess, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe somebody's having a health issue and all of a sudden there's some device that detects it in the house and then utilize whatever.
Well, they kind of already have that.
Right. Well, we have some of that. But you know what I'm
looking
saying?
Looking for one of those for my mom.
You know what I'm talking about, right? The Amazon pickers, which we have too. But that whole thing, which creates mini robots or even nanos, by the way, to solve health issues.
Yeah, but I think like this is where we get into this like fantastical area of thought when we're looking at the MAGA movement that I think is, you know, you sort of say, are we really advancing as a society? Are we really moving to the Jetsons or are we kind of haven't gone anywhere? Because when I was in Orvieto, I think those people were way smarter than us.
Oh yeah.
Today.
Yes.
So if you go back thousands of years, I think they were actually smarter than we are today. And Orvieto is proof of it. You know, it's like these people were super smart. How did they build this stuff? How did they get everything up that hill? And then I was dumb enough to put in the mapping to drive through Orvieto.
Oh yeah.
Okay. So then I got stuck in the middle of the city and I started yelling at my wife, why did you just put in the mapping? This is an ancient city. It's not made for cars.
No.
You know? Yeah. So I'm starting to panic because the car doesn't even fit in the road and I don't even know what to do, you know?
Yeah.
And then I couldn't even turn right because it was not wide enough where it was telling me to turn. So I went the wrong way up a street and sure enough, it opened up into a parking lot. I was like, thank freaking God.
And by the way, I must have been in that car with you
because
I had that exact experience, by the way.
I'm sure you did because you put into Google, take me to the restaurant in Orvieto to the main square, right?
Yep, that's right.
And then it tries to kill you.
Yeah.
Talk about AI.
Yep.
Show me a way through Orvieto that doesn't kill me. That would be great, Google.
But let's continue with the robot and the whole robo-taxi thing.
So here's the idea of technology. All technology that has been wildly successful simply makes our lives more efficient and better. It simply does that. Okay.
Right.
Uber is a perfect example of that. Uber, when it came out, taking cabs sucked.
Horrible.
It never was a good experience.
Horrible.
You call these people, they may or may not show. And when my business partner actually showed me Uber the first time, I actually had my own driver. You know, I tell this story a lot, and I used to call this guy, and he would pick me up and take me to clubs and wait and then drive me home, okay, because I didn't want to get a DUI, and I'd go out, and I was single. And he goes, oh, we got Uber. You don't need Alex anymore. Coincidentally, the guy's name's Alex. And you don't need Alex anymore. I didn't want my real Alex to get upset. And and it's like, you don't need Alex anymore. I can go on my phone, and I can order a black car, because Uber was originally just black cars, you know? And they ordered the car on the phone. It came, picked us up. We went out clubbing. It was a really fun night, actually, in hindsight. And then we called the car and it took us home. And I was like, this is an amazing technology, you know?
Yeah.
Like amazing. So when you think about the cell phone, for example, like before cell phones, you know, you just didn't communicate, you know? Yeah. And all of a sudden you got a phone. It was like, I could walk around with a phone. I think my first phone was like a Nokia, you know, and you'd make calls. There was no texting. And then there was the BlackBerry era when we came up with this innovation that we could text, you know? So like most technologies really make our lives better. And now we finally reached a point where technologies are making our lives worse. And the example of that is social media. So like today, there's no doubt in my mind that Steve Jobs had no intention that young people would be walking around staring at phones all day. That is not what his intention was when he built the iPhone at all. He didn't think so at all.
He was
thinking like, wow, this is great to connect to the internet and you can listen to your music and make calls, you know?
That was pretty much it. I agree.
Yeah, that was all he, you know?
And read email.
And so today, like the Facebook era and the social media era, you know, is basically just like destroyed the minds of our youth. And they're fine doing this, the technologists, because they've made so much money doing it, you know? But it hasn't added to our lives. And that's where I fear this robot stuff goes. See, having a robot that just walks around and does laundry is not going to improve my life in any way, because the person who does it in my house is quite nice and I have no reason to replace them. Okay. There's not an inefficiency here.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So when you think about where are there inefficiencies that can be solved with robotics, there are lots of jobs that are quite dangerous or difficult, you know? And so you're like, okay, I put a robot in charge of like cleaning the turbine engines of the plane or something like that, you know, where it's like dangerous or, you know, or unhealthy, you know, like mining jobs are unhealthy.
Window cleaning.
You know? Yeah, like those dudes that go outside on high rises. That could definitely be something that's a robot. And and humans do this, but you know, you're like, if we could just come up with an easier way to clean windows on high rises, that's a great use of a robot. You see what I'm saying?
I get it.
And just stick to the window and go up and down all day. And I got this robotic kitty litter box. And it really just like my cat poops and it does the circle and it gets the poop into a bag.
Oh, that's helpful.
And then he just,
that's helpful.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, that's good.
I've never cleaned crap
you
once.
Need,
I've had this pet.
And you don't need $1 trillion to program that. But what about the robo-taxi,
which
is the, again, I think more than anything, I think. Well,
we don't need robo-taxis.
We don't need them. Why do we need the robo-taxi? What is the whole thing with Elon with the robot?
We don't need them.
Is it a carrot, though? Is the robo-taxi a carrot for Tesla? Because somehow it's almost like a trigger for investors.
The idea is that we're not going to drive anymore. So there's somebody at Tesla named Elon Musk and maybe some other people who think people like us are going to stop driving and that these robo-taxis will be ubiquitous. They'll be everywhere. And you'll just like step out onto the street and a robo-taxi will pick you up and it'll take you home. And then you want to leave for work, you step out of your house and a robo-taxi will pick you up and take you home. I'm not really sure about this vision because it would involve replacing like pretty much every car that exists.
And which is good for Tesla, which is good for Tesla.
Well, yes. But when I talked to Elon originally, when we actually cared about climate change, and I said to him once, I said, well, you know, it was a question actually at one of the events. And I said, you know, if Tesla can make X amount of cars, like how many years would it take? Like if we make as many electric cars, like how many years would it take to replace the vehicle fleet? And it was basically like 20 years, you know? So it takes 20 years to replace the vehicle fleet if everybody just bought new cars that were autonomous. So if we had something that actually worked today and you say, okay, there's 75 million vehicles sold globally annually, who could get up to 75 million production of autonomous vehicles? You know, it's just not going to happen. So people are going to drive regular cars until I die. That's what I think. And I'll be one of them because I love driving.
But I would speak for you. You would not be unwilling to get behind the wheel of a quote unquote autonomous driving car and let the car do its thing. But I take Waymos all the time.
I take Waymo now all the time. I don't like Uber.
Right.
Because Uber is a horrible experience, like from the perspective of a robocab. So that's the innovation, is getting the human out of the car. And most of the humans driving Ubers in LA are not from LA. They're not good drivers. They don't smell good. It's just not a good experience.
The whole time I was thinking the smell, I didn't want to say it. I was thinking, as you're,
no, I'll
as,
say it.
As
it
you're
sucks.
Talking about
Every
it,
time I, was like, I can spend $180 to go to the airport in an Uber and it smells like crap in the car.
Something happened.
And I hate to tell the guy this, you know, and I'm like, dude, you've been sitting in this car for 73 hours straight and it reeks, you know?
Yep. From everything.
And I'm like,
So what about
when I get in a Waymo, it's like, smells like roses. There's no person in there.
But Waymo could be any car with a Waymo tech. That's the big issue. And that was the hope. I thought really from a Tesla standpoint that they would have the services component that would pay for, you know, they would bring in all sorts of money. And that's why that I think that Elon keeps, I see it. He keeps on talking about this. And every time he talks about it, the stock goes up, even though sales honestly suck at Tesla.
Right.
I mean, horrible.
And it's worse now than ever.
Right.
But like, see, the whole cab thing too is I always like had this vision that Tesla would make these amazing electric vehicles that could drive themselves. Because what I actually really want is when I'm driving to the Dodger game in the World Series, that I can just push a button and it will drive me.
Yeah. Congratulations, by the way.
So thank you. So if I can push a button and my car drives me around completely safe, like a Waymo.
Yeah.
That's a huge win for Tesla.
Huge win.
So the model is we sell you a car and it can drive itself and it's electric. And I think you could sell 10 to 20 million of these a year. And that was the original goal of Tesla. Okay. But once Elon came out as an extremist, which is what he is kind of, it's like, you know, he turned off like pretty much everybody, you know? And then it was like, well, the right wingers still like him. And then he turned those people off. And so when you're like, who actually likes Elon anymore? It's basically like white male tech geeks that love Tesla. That's it. Which and is it's not a big market.
Interesting, because you said when you originally started talking with Elon back in the day and why you probably bought Tesla as a stock, which you made a tremendous amount of money on. I know
Remind me of Apple.
Yeah, right. But now, I mean, the Ford F-150 Lightning production being canceled.
I know. I'm so pissed about
which
it.
Is,
I'm
which
so
is,
pissed because Elon forced these companies to go electric. And I care about climate. And I think climate solutions is where there's money. And so it's like, now all these companies are like, thank God we don't have to do this anymore and compete with Tesla so we can go back to selling gas guzzlers and making much bigger profits.
I mean, the hybrid's not the worst idea for...
No, hybrid is a good solution,
for like an F-150 where you're worried about... I mean, you can get the torque, don't get me wrong, but worried about the longevity of the truck.
It's the range anxiety thing, yeah.
There's a lot of range. I just thinking about it gives me anxiety on that, you know?
Well, you know, it's one problem that I've never had, and as much as you worry about it, now the new Rivians are 400 miles a charge, so it's farther than a gas car.
You own Rivian stock? You own Rivian stock?
I don't own the stock.
Did you see the pay packages that came out?
Yeah, and you know, I don't know what's wrong with all these people, you know. But like, RJ has not done a great job, you know, no offense. I love Rivian, and so just full disclosure, I love Rivian. I don't own the stock. I own a car. I own a car, which I really like. Mm-hmm. I think they make wonderful EVs, but I think operationally they're just challenged. I just don't think they have the work ethic and the type of focus like Tesla had to really get to where they need to be. They just need to be pushed harder, and that's a management issue. So RJ's a great marketer and he's built a great brand, but I just don't see the, like, when you go to Tesla, like, I was reading about like the Tesla meeting, all hands meeting they just had, where Elon's now basically saying 2026 is going to be the hardest year of your life. Cause if we don't achieve all these things, we're going to be in trouble. And I was like, as much as I hate the fact that Tesla's in this like really tough situation, I'm like, I love the work ethic.
Yeah, sure.
I love it.
Sleeping on the floor.
Elon will die. He'll die trying. That's why I don't bet against these people. You know what I mean? And so, you know, I still own $90 million worth of Tesla stock somehow. And, you know, people say, well, you don't like Elon, you don't like what they're doing in their direction. I said, I'm not saying they're going to fail, though. Right. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I'm not betting against them for sure. But what I do know is that I'm not going to give up driving. My kids will drive, but they probably don't care as much as adults. I don't think Tesla's technology in its current hardware setup is good enough to compete with Waymo. Waymo completed 1 million robo-taxi rides last month in California. This is impressive. They're everywhere where I go now. I think they're the first mover. And because it's Google, I think they dominate. I think
and
Tesla's
they have the backing.
Messing around has the cost backing, them.
Right?
They got plenty of money. Yeah, right. Money. And there's a reason for Waymo to exist beyond taking rides, because Google understands they've got you captive in the car and they're an ad model. And so when you're driving for your 30 minutes in the Waymo, soon it'll be things like, do you want to watch ads and your ride will be cheaper?
Right.
Stuff like that.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's, we're getting to a point where Google can really monetize the cab in a different way than Tesla.
Right.
And so that's to their advantage. Tesla selling cars that drove themselves is a better business than being a cyber cab. The other thing with the cab business that's tough is they kind of assume that because there's no driver, that the making money part would be equal to what the driver would make. Mm-hmm. So if you're a full-time Uber driver, let's say you made $65,000 last year. Mm-hmm. So their assumption is like, well, then if I'm a full-time robo cab, then I'll just make $65,000 profit because I don't have a driver. But it doesn't quite work that way. And one of the reasons is because, you know, like there's certain times that drivers make more money than others, and the drivers learn when they want to drive depending on demand. Mm-hmm. And so when there's a concert that lets go and there's surge pricing, drivers make a lot more money than in the middle of the day when there's no demand. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So the way Uber works and the big challenge that they had early on in their existence, if you remember, was surge pricing mm-hmm. on New Year's Eve.
Oh, I remember.
Okay. And so you go out to your party on an Uber for $28 and then you try to leave, you know, at one.
Yeah.
And it was like $128.
Yep.
And people would freak out, you know, but that was just like the supply and demand dynamics that they hadn't smoothed out. Over time, they got enough drivers that drivers just come on Saturday night that want to deal with drunk people who drive across town because they make more money doing that, you know, drivers come off. So the idea that we're going to have just like millions of these cabs just like kind of just waiting around for rides all day long doesn't sound like margins going up. It sounds like margins going down.
And that's usually my
perception of what will happen with cab. In 5 years, the cabs will be free, basically.
Wow.
And especially in New York. You'll have to watch ads. You know, you'll watch YouTube.
Oh God, no. Don't talk about that. But it's a giant screen.
It's not us. This is what the kids do. The kids are perfectly fine trading their brain cells for free.
Yeah, I see it. Hey, listen, I want to just quickly finish up on something. First, I want to say something, Ross. I really enjoy talking to you. Seriously.
No, thanks.
I have so many guests. I've had 950 shows on this particular podcast. I have so many guests I've had over the years, and you are a treasure. I really appreciate that.
Oh, thanks. I really appreciate that. That's why I like doing your show, because I enjoy talking to you too.
Thanks. So let's talk about the massive energy need for.
Oh, I'm investing in this.
These data centers. And I actually have a few investors. We made on companies that I usually would not invest in. I'm like, okay, at the beginning of the year, like for example, full disclosure, SMR, Oklo, CEG, you know, these companies have made me.
Be careful with nuclear.
No, clearly, but I'm out of them primarily. I just hit them a little bit recently this week again, but we made like 600% on these things. So I'm clean on those profits. Let's talk about that. Where are we going?
So this is actually the part, now you're getting into what I'm actually working on. So we look at AI like any other gold rush, where it's like the most obvious place you think to make money is usually not OpenAI, mm-hmm. you know, Microsoft. Not that I think Microsoft will do fine, but I'm just saying, where is there real money to be made? And one of the things that I learned when the Palisades burned down was I started watching infrastructure being rebuilt. And the first thing they started working on power, they're still working on power. And I start hanging out with these power guys, right? Because they're outside of my house every day. And they're, boy, these guys are like, it's such a specialized skill, okay? Like putting in power transmission lines and all this kind of stuff, it's not like you could just like go to school and do this and be good at it. It's, you're climbing poles, you're dealing with high powered wires. It's a skill that you learn through working on the job. It's a union job. And the way the cities do this is they outsource to companies. So it's not like this, like we do have the Department of Water and Power here in LA, which is unique, but most power companies are privately owned or they outsource power services like transmission lines and fixing stuff. And one of the things I learned first hanging out with the power guys was that our infrastructure is pathetically old. The power that they were taking out of the Palisades, many of the poles were over 80 years old. Mm. They literally, my neighborhood was built 80 years ago. I think it was in the 50s and 40s. And it's the same poles. Okay, so it gives you an idea how aging the infrastructure is in the United States for power. Now, I started studying this many years ago with electric cars because what I was concerned about was power in the same reason. Like if everybody had an electric car, do we have enough power to do this? And if the price of power goes up substantially, then that defeats the purpose, right?
Yeah.
And then we have these clean energy sources like solar and nuclear. And so you've got many issues here to address. First, I'm building a big data center, let's say in Arizona. I think OpenAI says they're going to build a $1 trillion data center in Arizona. So you're talking about this massive footprint of thing. Now, if you've ever gone into a small data room in an office, for example, let's say it's a one room with a bunch of servers, it's hot as hell. Yep. And you got to run air conditioning through this stuff. And you got like 1,000 wires, you know, plugging all the server stuff. You got to hire all these people who manage it too. You know?
Yeah.
So running these things is complicated, expensive, and use a lot of power and a lot of humans, right?
Yeah.
And so we started looking at this and where I was like, oh my God, this is the opportunity. And it started with GE Verona for us, which we made a nice return off.
Symbol GEV. And
Then, you know, I stay away from, so my-
But they also got a big pick because of nuclear too, GE Verona.
Right. But see- My stepfather is one of the leading nuclear scientists in the world.
Oh.
So if there's anything nuclear related, I know more. I can learn more about this than anybody else.
Yeah.
And he like works with the Department of he's retired now, but Department of Energy is very close with everybody in the nuclear power industry. And he's literally the dude who like it builds nuclear power plants. And he has a very simple answer. There will be no nuclear power coming online for 7 to 10 years. It takes that long between regulation, building, safety, and then you got all the NIMBYs who go crazy when you try to build anything nuclear near them. Okay. So nuclear power is not a short-term solution for AI. So keep that in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's a long-term solution and one that we should address. And the government needs to subsidize nuclear because it has very low returns for investors. And so now the Trump administration announced that they're going to be supporting nuclear power, which is a great positive step, but there will not be any nuclear coming online anytime soon. Okay. Look at it that way.
Okay.
On the other side of the coin, we have natural gas, we have solar, we have other forms of energy. The best form of energy is from the sun, and it's solar power. So we have the ability to scale, you know, power generation pretty well if we want to using traditional methods, but we also need transmission and we need infrastructure and we need the ability to, you know,
to capture it.
Scale this up, right? Yeah. You know. And it's just a huge investment. Like it's so much work, like physical work building a data center. You know what I mean? And all the power around it. So we just bought stock in a company, Quanta Services, a PWR. And Quanta Services really does all that. You know, the servicing, the transmission lines, it's really a bricks and mortar play on AI.
Is that specific to solar or is that specific to?
No, it's specific to all the different types of energy generation.
So it's
more the like servicing, like connecting it, making sure the wires work, you know, like the whole bit.
Is it like a
generation of
like,
the power?
Is it like a Baker Hughes for the oil industry?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
So they do all the hard work.
Yeah.
Now it's not a high margin business because it's labor intensive, but you can't do anything without these people.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
You just can't. So we're looking at a couple other companies now in this area as well, which I'm not going to talk about because we haven't done anything yet with them. But like essentially this infrastructure is really the play. Is it, you know, an infrastructure in the United States is terrible, terrible. I mean, in the city of Los Angeles, for example, you know, because I'm working and trying to get rid of the communists running our city and, you know, so we got one city council person in who's wonderful, Tracy Park, who's wonderful in West LA. And, you know, and we had a meeting and she was just like, you know, the infrastructure in LA is so bad and antiquated. Everybody's upset about the fire. They don't want to know that 40% of the fire departments in LA are just unusable right now. The trucks don't work. You know, like infrastructure just is so old in our country in so many places, and it needs to be invested in. And part of that is the government, and part of that is the private sector. And so we're going nowhere without power.
No, it's clearly. No, there's no question about that.
We're going nowhere. It doesn't matter how much we talk about AI. They got, Satya said it the other day, Satya Nadella from Microsoft said, I got chips, I got a building, but I don't got power. So we can't scale any faster than we're scaling until we have power, you know?
Right.
And boy, you know, this is not something you do in a day. So, you know, if you're talking from scratch, I'm building a solar battery system, transmission lines into a new data center. This is a massive investment. And that's what's happening right now. So the good news is these are investments all in the United States. They create lots of jobs. It's very labor and skill intensive. And if you're a young person and you don't want to go to college, you could get a great job in the power industry. There's just no question.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think is one of the most interesting and important and crucial investments you can make as an investor. And my fund GK right now, we have two of these, and we just had a stock, Amphenol, which does all the wires in the data center. We've owned a stock called Trane Technologies, which does air conditioning systems, which I originally bought because they do heat pumps for climate change. And now it turns out, you know, we need all these air conditioning things on data centers too, you know. So Trane is in a great position with global warming and the huge demand for air conditioning just in general, because most of Europe doesn't actually have air conditioning. And then of course, now this data center demand is just wonderful for cooling products and such. So Trane is in a wonderful position as a company as well, which also has exposure to that. So we're continuing to build out what I call the bricks and mortar of AI, because I think that's in a lot of ways more interesting than the AI plays themselves.
Right, because either way, those could win.
They win because I posted this the other day. From 1875 to 19, let's say, to 2000, or to when the internet was created, let's say 1875 to 1995, mm-hmm. let's say.
Right.
Oil, the industrial era.
Right.
Factories, roads, trucking.
Right.
You know, this is how we built America, you know. And America is this wonderful story, the railroads, the communication, the telegraph that was laid next to the railroads, the communication. And when you look at infrastructure is what America made America wealthy. We weren't a rich nation. We were a bunch of farmers until we had railroads. And once we could trade and move goods and communicate, all of a sudden that infrastructure made America extremely powerful and wealthy. Okay. Because all of a sudden consumers all around, not just the United States, but even globally, could have access to our food. For example, our cattle. So shipping cattle from Chicago to New York, right? Yeah. So now you go from 1995 to the present's all been about the internet, which runs on electricity. So we've moved from an oil-based power system around cars and trucks and oil and factories to now an electrical-based system that ideally cars and trucks and factories and everything will work on electrical-based systems now, okay? And the problem is none of that infrastructure, the railroads, the telegraphs, that hasn't really been built.
None of it works on it.
Or what we want it to become. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So for this vision to be actualized in the next 20 years, which is our lifetime, infrastructure is going to be the absolute key to the success of it. Right. More so than the innovation itself.
Yeah, amazing. Ross Gerber from Gerber Kawasaki. I will have the information on how to get in touch with you over on the show notes for episode number 947. You can find him on Twitter. You can find him everywhere that social media is. And I really appreciate you coming on board today, as always, giving us an incredible depth of information on all sorts of topics. Thanks so much.
No, I appreciate it. Now I want to go buy some more power stocks.
There you go. We'll get them.
I convinced myself.
I'll see you soon. Thanks.
Yeah, take care, Andrew.
Great. How great is that discussion with Ross? I mean, we have a great synergy there. We should probably do a show like more regularly, I think. I'll have to talk to him about that. Anyway, things are interesting, to say the least, of what's going on right now in the markets. And I think he makes some very good points with regard to, you know, we're not necessarily in a bubble, but we're in a valuation question mark. And there is great opportunity to be had right now. And then there's going to be winners and losers, like we've seen, but yet at the same time, there's a lot of money to be made, a lot of money to be spread around. So we'll keep a watch on that for you as well. As I mentioned, go over to The Disciplined Investor. You can see the show notes, everything. And by the way, we have some AI-generated show notes if you want to read it and catalog it on the episode show notes page. So that's over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I want to thank you for joining me this week and every week. A shout out to all of our great clients. Thank you for all that you've done, you do, and thank you for believing in us, trusting us with your hard-earned capital, your life savings. We hope that many more of you will come on board over the next times, the weeks, the months, the years that we're here. Plenty more to go of The Disciplined Investor. Stay disciplined, stay investing. Keep your head up and watch for the opportunities. Thanks for joining me this week. I'll see you again real soon. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.